Good morning, New Mexico. Welcome to the Santa Fe Radio Cafe. My name is Mary Charlotte. We're broadcasting from the Santa Fe Baking Company, streaming on the web at ksfr.org, podcasting at santafe.radiocafe.org, thanks to Dotfoil Computer Services, and we're at facebook.com/radiocafe. I'm delighted now to welcome back to the program Stephen Kotler. He is the author of the book A Small Furry Prayer, Dog Rescue and the Meaning of Life, which we've already talked about on this show, but he's going to be speaking at Santa Fe Complex this coming Wednesday at 6 o'clock. Welcome back to the Radio Cafe.
Thank you for having me.
So you are talking about, of course, dogs, dog rescue. What's the specific angle that you're pursuing right now?
The core of the talk is going to be, Rancho de Chihuahua, which is the dog sanctuary I run with my wife, is the only, to the best of our knowledge, is the only sanctuary in America that uses cognitive neuroscience and evolutionary psychology in their healing methodology. So essentially, I'm going to be talking about what the heck that means.
Which we can talk about now to some extent.
Absolutely.
So first of all, you got into dog rescue through falling in love with somebody who was a dog rescuer, ended up from L.A. coming out here to New Mexico, starting Rancho de Chihuahua. And one of the things that you found was that in order to deal with dogs, you had to actually develop a kind of empathy and a kind of connection with them, seeing that we were, on some level, all part of the same, if not human race, the same type of being.
I think there's a two-part answer to that. The first part, which is probably the bigger part, and we could probably talk about it for longer, but it's not at the center of your question, is one of the things I noticed over the past 4 or 5 years running this is ever since Rene Descartes came up with the idea of I think, therefore I am, the reason Descartes said that is it's because he had language skills, and animals didn't have language skills, so Descartes had decided to doubt everything he could not prove. He could not prove that animals thought because they didn't have language, so he decided they couldn't. He decided they were just machines with incredibly, you know, intricate parts. After that happened, humans have come up with a very, very long list of things that separate them from animals. We're the only species to have domesticated another animal. We're the only species to have consciousness, laughter, homosexuality, imitative behavior, on and on and on. There's a very long list. As it turns out, in the years I've been working with dogs, every single one of the behaviors that is supposed to be a human-only behavior, I've seen in my dogs.
So, homosexuality, for one.
Laughter is another one. Laughter requires a level of consciousness and self-awareness.
Your dogs laugh?
My dogs have laughed. Anybody's dogs laugh, and you can actually get online. This woman named Patricia Simon did a lot of this research, and you can get online and type in dog laughter, and you can hear what canine laughter sounds like. Some of the research is really amazing. If you go into a shelter, which, as you probably can imagine, are pretty barky, you can play canine laughter over the loudspeakers, and within 30 seconds, it'll just quiet down. So anyways, there's that long list of things that I've seen in my dogs, and other researchers as well, by the way, have seen this. So the separation between humans and dogs has gotten very, very, you know, fuzzy at this point. The second half of your question, which was more about empathy, that was, first of all, when I started this, I did not think humans and dogs were equal at all. But at all, I thought humans were probably the more superior species, first of all, and other things along those lines. And obviously there was some tension between my wife and myself on this particular topic that we had to kind of work around. But one of the things
because she definitely took humans are not superior to other species point of view.
She took humans are not superior to other species point of view, and she also very much agrees with Peter Singer, who says the question is really, do animals suffer? Do they suffer? That's the only question that matters, and if the answer is yes, then they should be treated equally. And so that was her perspective on it. For me, what I found, because of the work we do, Rancho de Chihuahua is not kind of a standard dog sanctuary. We do hospice care, and we do long, long, long-term rehabilitation for physically and emotionally sick and traumatized animals. And so that could mean feral dogs, very abused dogs. It's not unusual for us to have dogs that have severe problems with men, and, you know, dogs that will bark at me or try to attack me for months.
Because of their abuse history, presumably.
Because of their past. And it'll go on for months and months and months on end. And it's not just one or two animals. There's a lot of animals in our care, and it could be five or six of them. And, you know, if you want to run around believing that you're superior to animals and that, you know, I was raised in the Midwest where, you know, a man is king of his castle and this is my house and these dogs are in it type of thing. And I would get chased out of rooms routinely for months on end by, like, barking, snarling dogs. And if I wanted to feel superior to them, it was just going to make my life miserable because I was not going to win that one. The dog was not going to get better. And what I learned kind of as a survival state and as a way to kind of, like, on a certain level, protect my marriage early on, was that I had to start thinking about the dogs the way I would think about a sick friend or my mother or something along those lines, and, you know, treat them that way, that kind of empathy. And what happened was, once I started treating them with this kind of empathy, obviously, you know, just the act of doing it, when you, empathy is one of these things, when you fake it, you actually start feeling it, right? So it ended up kind of spinning my head around. I started seeing a totally different world of dogs that I'd ever seen before. And really, by just changing my own perspective, I started noticing much more in their behavior. I really kind of opened my mind to the dogs, and the dogs kind of responded in kind. So it worked for me. But the empathy was kind of a, you know, it was something I had to learn in the beginning.
And it's kind of encouraging when one hears that, because that means, you, first of all, that you can learn empathy. I think it's also a really important part of what you're saying is that when you respond in an empathetic manner toward dogs, they change their behavior toward you.
Significantly.
Well, give us some examples of what that looked like.
I mean, you know, some of it just looks like, it just looks like trust building in any way. But what you start to see is, you know, just like in humans, fear is not a very comfortable emotion to feel, and it limits your responses. Right? If you're feeling fear, if you're in that state, you're not very creative in how you're solving problems and how you're doing anything. You have very simple responses. Same thing with animals. By being more empathetic to my dogs, they obviously felt more comfortable. I was obviously feeling for them. And because of that, you know, all of a sudden their behavior, their range of behavior started to expand, and I started seeing more and more interesting things from them. One of the things that really happened is that we see a tremendous amount of behavior in our pack that doesn't show up in the scientific literature, right, as I mentioned. One of the most profound things was the amount of empathy and cooperation in our pack that we started to see. And this really did start occurring once I started empathizing with the dogs. Joy didn't have to actually make any changes in herself. But once I started really kind of changing my behavior a lot, we started seeing massive amounts of cooperative behavior, empathetic behavior. That was around the time one of the clearest examples is we feed our dogs chicken seed style. So there'll be a huge pack of dogs, 20, 30 dogs on the back porch, and instead of, you know, separating them apart, we scatter food on the back porch like chicken seed, and they all share. And there's never any biting or arguing or anything else like this. But that was something that we were able to move into once I started kind of empathizing with the dogs a little bit more.
Now, one of the things that you explore in your book is the mystery, at least according to science, I mean, it seems sort of obvious to many of us, but the mystery of cross-species empathy. In other words, when you look at it from an evolutionary biology point of view, there are all sorts of theories about within human beings or within any species, there are reasons, there are evolutionary reasons why somebody might sacrifice themselves or be altruistic for other members of their pack or their group, because it helps that group in the long run. But there is not, I mean, I think it's a, is it a scientific dead end? Like, why human beings would be altruistic or empathetic toward dogs, or why any animal would be good to another animal?
Well, there's a couple different answers there. Animals being good to each other, I'll give you a really weird fact that I...
Across species.
Well, let's go in species for a second. Let's talk about wolves. The limit on wolf pack size is not food. It's not availability of food, which is what you would think it is. It turns out it actually social bonds. If the wolves are not fulfilled, if their social bonds are not fulfilled in the way, they'll split up the pack. They'll go to a smaller pack size. So those kind of social relationships are hugely important. What you're talking about is the problem with cross-species altruism is, you know, altruism's obviously been a puzzle going all the way back to, you know, the early days, to the Greeks and whatnot. And everybody's argued about it. Everybody's had a theory over the years and why it's important. And kind of in the 70s that got, in a sense, settled by Richard Dawkins when he published Selfish Gene. And Dawkins basically said genes are the fundamental unit of selection, and because they're selfish, they only want to propagate themselves, it trumps everything else. And so altruism, everything we call altruism, cooperation, empathy, all that kind of stuff, essentially becomes selfishness in disguise. So this is kind of the standard theory. What happened to me is when I kind of poked my head into the rescue world is I very quickly realized that the massive amount of sacrifice that I was seeing from rescuers did not fit with the logic. First of all, I was seeing people, you know, right and left. First of all, you know, we were in L.A., and we knew people who would do things like they would go into the inner city, into Watts, and they would try to liberate pit bulls from the fighting circuit. So they would break into gang members' houses and steal back their dogs. I'm not, you know, saying this is good behavior or bad behavior. What I'm saying is, oh my God, you're risking your life and your limb for, you know, a dog you've never met before. Right. That's kind of extraordinary. And I started to realize that most of the rescuers I was meeting, even people making six-figure salaries, were broke all the time. All their money was going to dogs, especially in the cities, because what would happen is zoning laws limited people to three dogs. So maybe they'd break that and have five or eight in their apartment, but rescuers were boarding 10, 20, 30, 40 dogs at a time. And so even people making tons of money were broke all the time. None of this fits with our thinking about altruism. I mean, the real kind of core idea there is selfish genes. You know, we help those who help us pass along our genes, and it doesn't really matter what I do for a dog. None of it is going to help me pass along my genes. So that got really, really, really confusing. So one of the questions I set out to answer in A Small Furry Prayer is, what the heck's going on here?
Right. And so, I mean, what did you... There was a theory that didn't go very far, which is that people who help animals, for example, maybe that bolsters their reputation in the community. But anybody who thinks about people who live in an apartment with 73 dogs running around, that does not bolster their reputation.
And the flip side of that is most of the people, myself included now, most of the people who are real serious about animal rescue, we move to the middle of nowhere, get as much property and as few neighbors as possible. That's the goal, right? And so it doesn't, I mean, I can enhance my reputation all I want. There's nobody around to notice where I live. You know what I mean? I'm not getting any more resources because of that.
We're talking to Stephen Kotler. So why this interspecies, I mean, let's call it love?
Well, okay, so to answer your question, and this is some of what I'm going to talk about in my talk on at the complex next week, you have to kind of go back and kind of revisit everything you think about human and canid coevolution. So the old idea was that humans domesticated dogs, right? We're the only species that domesticated another species. First of all, that's not true. And second of all, we didn't domesticate dogs. And the reason we know this, there's actually a lot of reasons, but the simplest one is what Raymond Coppinger, what a scientist named Raymond Coppinger discovered, which is that the idea of with wolves was that we stole cute wolf pups and then raised them as our own. The problem is that wolves exhibit neoteny, which is they retain their puppy-like characteristics, which makes animals very easy to train until they become independent. But wolves only retain their neoteny for 13 days. So you have essentially 13 days to steal your wolf cub, or it doesn't happen. So you've got roving bands of hunter-gatherers. Now, when humans and dogs started to co-evolve, or wolves started to co-evolve together, there's some debate, but the early number is 32,000 years. The later number is 135,000 years. It's probably somewhere in the middle. But anyways, you're still dealing with hunter-gatherer tribes. This is before the discovery of agriculture. And they're running around the world. They don't, 13 days, you've got 13 days to capture a wolf cub and raise it. Sure, it may have happened once or twice, but not enough for wolves to turn into dogs. So that idea went out the window. The new idea is that wolves domesticated themselves. They wanted our garbage. So once when we settle down for the winter in caves and whatnot, we produce these huge midden piles, and wolves wanted it. There was leftover vegetables, there was leftover meat. And so they started kind of going after our garbage. And the wolves who were less frightened of us were the ones who got more food because we would approach and they wouldn't run away. And they obviously got more food than everybody else. So essentially, more food, more offspring, better kin, their offspring. This is called flight distance, which is essentially how close will you let something dangerous get to you before you run away. So the wolves with higher flight distances were the ones that had the most kids, got the most food, and it got passed down. But essentially, they domesticated themselves. So as it turns out, having wolves around is massively beneficial for humans. In the beginning, we liked them because they were our burglar alarms. They barked at danger. They had better hearing, better smell. They barked at danger. It was also usually helpful to have them clean up our garbage because there was less disease. So these are very, very beneficial. And that was in the beginning. There's a lot of proof now that we learned how to hunt from wolves. Wolves could huge, big, coordinated pack hunting drives that primates really didn't know how to do. We were frugivores. We ran around in the jungle. When we ended up down in the savannah, we had to learn how to hunt. We had to learn how to live differently. And so there's a lot of thinking, and a lot of it's by a guy named Wolfgang Schleit, who's at the University of Vienna, really brilliant, brilliant, brilliant ethologist. He's actually took Conrad Lorenz's chair, if that means anything to you.
I love that a wolf specialist is called Wolfgang.
Wolfgang, yeah. He's brilliant. He's amazing. But Wolfgang Schleit's idea is essentially that wolves were the first what he calls mammalian pastoralists, meaning they chase large herds of ungulates across plains, and we wanted to learn it, so we started tagging along with them. Anyways, long story short, if we wanted to cohabitate with wolves, if we wanted to be around wolves, they were used to living in larger groups, larger packs. We needed better cooperation skills, better patience. Actually, certain people are probably more prone to mutiny than others. That was probably passed down. So essentially what happened is evolution started selecting for wolf lovers. Because it was so beneficial having them around, we started, people who were good with animals. Like today, there are people who are better with animals and people who are worse. Same thing going back into prehistory. So essentially, evolution started selecting for animal lovers because it was so beneficial having them around. So the answer to where does cross-species altruism come from is essentially a long lineage of people, descendant from those original wolf lovers. The original people who helped us kind of cohabitate with wolves were so critical that there's a pretty good chance we're all descended from them on some level.
We recently on this program interviewed Kevin Bian, who wrote the book Your Dog is Your Mirror, and he talks about that and the ways, I'd never really thought about this before, the ways in which dogs and humans mirror each other more than dogs and our closest relatives, chimps and so on, in the sense that we both hunt game much bigger than ourselves, especially wolves more than coyotes, but we need to develop social skills and kind of group mind behavior in order to pull off those feats of hunting. And who learned the hunting from whom? I'm not sure.
It's an interesting question. Kevin's book is great. I actually think he and I have similar theories, and we're just kind of like mirror halves of our theories. I've actually been meaning to get in touch with him because his book was really exciting to me. But one of the things that is really interesting about that question, and people don't often realize this, is when you're hunting large prey, as wolves did, as humans did, you can't get hurt in the wild. In prehistoric culture, if you broke your arm, you were going to be somebody's lunch. If you got a bad cut, you were going to get infected. So it wasn't so much just that we were hunting game larger than ourselves. It was there was no margin for error. You couldn't screw up. So when they talk about us learning cooperative behavior from wolves and learning how to hunt as a pack, one of the reasons it really got passed down, evolutionarily speaking, is because you couldn't mess up. Any error, and it was going to be the end of your life, you weren't going to pass on your genes. So the people who were better at cooperation, coordination, all these kind of group skills are the ones who survived. It's not just that they got more food, it's that they didn't die while getting the food.
We're talking to Stephen Cutler. His book is called A Small Furry Prayer, Dog Rescue and the Meaning of Life, and he will be speaking on Wednesday at Santa Fe Complex about dogs and their special relationship with humans. Now, let's talk for a moment about this whole idea of imitation and mirror neurons and how we learn from each other. We have this as human beings. Dogs have it too. Is that correct?
First of all, mirror neurons, I won't go through the whole history of them, but they're essentially neurons in the brain that allow us to imitate what other people do. Now, at a certain level, it's imitative. It's physical behavior. Language is an imitative skill, but so is empathy. Empathy, emotions are an imitative skill. So mirror neurons kind of start at imitative behavior and go all the way up through empathy. There's kind of a continuum.
Road rage is an imitation. It's a learned skill.
Road rage is definitely a learned skill, and I've unlearned it since I've left California.
Good.
So one of the things in the beginning we found mirror neurons in the 90s, and a bunch of scientists in Italy found them in chimpanzees. So there has been an ongoing search for mirror neurons ever since. And the new thinking is they show up in pretty much every mammal. So the question is, how developed are they? The idea for a while was that humans must have the most hyper-developed mirror neurons out there, and that may actually still be the case. But one of the things we're starting to realize is dogs have exquisitely developed mirror neuron systems. So here's why. Have you ever seen the show Lie to Me?
No.
Okay, it's about face reading. Essentially, your face and your emotions are hardwired together. So you can't have an emotion without having a corresponding facial expression. It's impossible. The reason you can't smile on command for the camera, for example, is when you're truly happy, there's a muscle that you can't, well, very few people can voluntarily control it, that's underneath your eyelid that pulls up your eyelid. So when you smile on command, you can't, this muscle doesn't work, but when you're smiling naturally, it raises your eyelid.
You have to think of something that makes you happy.
You have to think of something that makes you happy. And one of the things that happens, by the way, is when that eyelid pulls up, you get a little squirt of, I believe it's serotonin. So you get a little feel-good chemical that doesn't come when you fake a smile. So when wolves teamed up with humans, they needed to be able to read our facial expressions. And especially as kind of coevolution progressed and we... Coevolution and domestication, or mutual domestication, however you want to call it, is essentially, you know, the outsourcing of basic survival skills. So wolves took over safety and security for us, but we took control of their food supply. So as we started to control their food supply, it was very, very important for them to understand what was going on in our heads and our brains, you know, what we were feeling. The way you understand what another creature is feeling is you mimic their facial expressions, and you mimic their body gestures, but especially their facial expressions, because by mimicking facial expressions, that's how you feel what another feels. That's how empathy works. So if I mimic your facial expressions and your body posture, I will physically feel what you're feeling, right? Same thing works with animals. They mimic our facial expressions. So one of the puzzles I poke at in Small Furry Prayer is it's been pretty well established that over periods of time, dogs and their owners start to resemble one another. And there have been a couple studies. Studies really find this with purebreds. They haven't found it as much with mutts, though I don't understand why. That's still a bit of a mystery. But here's the reason. Your skin is elastic. So is your dog's skin. And if they're trying to figure out what you're thinking, because it's important to them, they're mimicking your facial expressions. And by mimicking your facial expressions, they're feeling your feelings. Skin is elastic. This goes on over a long period of time. Not only are they going to start to look like you, they're also going to start to behave like you, which is why dogs often act like their owners. Kevin, in the book that you just mentioned, he often talks about, you know, he can go to a dog park and, you know, if a dog's really nervous, anxious, and whatever, guaranteed the owner is nervous and anxious. The dog's just feeling the same feelings and expressing it that way.
Right. I actually probably shouldn't have, but I told an owner of a very nervous dog that in the dog park the other day, and it really, I mean, you could tell it struck her, and her whole posture changed, and she put the dog calmly down.
Yeah, when people figure out that their dogs are actually their mirrors, that they're really projecting out whatever people are feeling, and dogs are much, I mean, oftentimes, even if we don't know what we're feeling, our dogs do, because they're much better at face reading than we are as a general. The thinking right now is that dogs are better at face reading than humans are at it. What was more important for their survival, because we could communicate by a language, right? We could get information elsewhere. They could only get it from face reading.
They might be more like children in that way, in the sense, oh boy, mom's mad today.
That's exactly the problem. There's a lot of that in my house.
We're talking to Stephen Kotler. So there's some interesting examples in the book of the differences between wolves and dogs. And there are some things that dogs do that wolves don't do that in the past have been interpreted that to show that they were less intelligent, but have been rethought and reinterpreted to mean that they're actually more cooperative.
So imitative, before we knew there were mirror neurons, right, which kind of underlie imitative behavior, but before we knew there were mirror neurons in dogs and wolves and whatnot, the thinking was that wolves were smarter than dogs. And there's a number of reasons for this, one of which is during the process of domestication, brain size shrinks. So wild horses versus real horses, the brain has shrunk 16%. With pigs, it's 34%. It's a massive downgrade. With dogs, it's about 10%. One of the things, by the way, that's interesting, and one of the reasons we know that humans didn't domesticate dogs, and we know that humans are not the only species to have domesticated another animal, is the new thinking is that wolves domesticated us as much as as we domesticated them. And bit of proof is that the human brain has shrunk by 10% over the past 50,000 years or so, which is a sure sign of domestication.
Can I just ask you a question as we talk about this? My Jack Russell Terrier is probably smarter than many Rottweilers, and its brain is much, much smaller. I mean, what does brain size really prove?
So brain size doesn't prove anything. What we know of as intelligence, the current thinking, is really numbers of connections between neurons matter. So some of what we're talking about is what kind of learning-rich environment was that animal raised in. So if you want to talk about my dog is smarter than your dog, on a certain level what you may be saying is my dog was raised in a much more high-stimulus environment
than
your dog.
But some dog breeds are smarter than others.
Some dog breeds are smarter than others, and a lot of that has to do with, you know, our fetishization of breeds. I mean, breeds is it essentially artificial construct that we've created. It's not a good one. I mean, for the health of the dog, one of the reasons you see so much canine aggression these days, it's a real problem. It's a growing problem. It's getting worse rather than better, is because of inbreeding. It used to be, for example, Labradors were playful, loving, great around children, wonderful, and more and more and more, they're getting to be very, very aggressive.
Just because they're overbred.
They're overbred. It's inbreeding. So, you know, there's a lot wrong kind of with the breeders' clubs and the way, you know, people think about that. There are certain breeders who are fantastic, who are great, who totally get it, you know, and understand the genetics, understand the science, and, you know, are working to end these problems and are great. And there are a lot of others who just are in it for the money and they don't understand what they're doing and, you know, we're essentially degrading dogs.
Let's go back to this question of the difference between dogs and wolves.
Oh, okay. So so there was the domestication, brain size shrunk, and so we thought dogs were stupider. And a lot of it was based on this crazy experiment where wolves could open a latch gate after watching humans do it once, and dogs couldn't do it. It took them a bunch of tries to do it. And for a long time, everybody, this one experiment was kind of like the killer app of, oh, dogs are stupider than wolves. And then a guy in Hungary, and I'm blanking his name right now, it'll pop into my head in half a second, had a bunch of dogs at home and went, God, this doesn't make sense. My dogs are pretty smart. He said, maybe it's not that dogs are stupider than wolves. It's maybe they're more attuned to human desire, and they weren't opening the gate because they were waiting for permission to open the gate. So he essentially reduplicated the experiment a number of different ways, and sure enough, once humans kind of told them it was okay to open the gate, the dogs massively outperformed the wolves. But I'll tell you a really crazy imitative behavior story. I spend a lot of time running with the dogs in kind of the backcountry behind my house in the arroyos, and the arroyos are really deep, and they can you can use them like skate parks. And so I have a pit bull heeler mix. Her name is Bella, and she's incredibly acrobatic, really, really, really acrobatic, and can do all kinds of crazy stuff. And one of her favorite things to do is to run up one side of the arroyos, jump off that side, kind of spin around, you know, do twists in the air, basically, and land on the other side. So this was a number of years ago, and we had another dog, a bull terrier named Igor, who was a klutz. And we were out running the arroyos, and Bella was doing all kinds of tricks, and Igor kept disappearing, and I would always have to call for him and go find him, and it got really annoying. So one day, I basically decided to stalk him. While he was gone, I was going to backtrack until I could find him, rather than kind of going on my hike and seeing if he'd catch up or whatever. And I backtracked, And that day, Bella had done, you know, her typical kind of spin move in midair, and she'd done it off this, like, weird boulder that protruded out of the side of the arroyo like a diving board, and she had landed like a cat on the other side. So I backtracked about a half mile to this exact spot, and Igor was practicing Bella's move. She was doing the exact same move, running up one side, leaping off the rock, trying to spin around. And Igor was a klutz, as I said, so he kept, like, literally crashing into dirt and, you know, trying it over and over and over again. This kind of... ethologists, people who study behavior, call this they call this projects. And the behavior's been observed before. It hasn't been seen in dogs that often, but it shows up all the time in dolphins, for example. And it showed up in monkeys and things along those lines. And I'm sure there's probably some wolf stuff and things along those lines. But that's incredibly high-level imitated behavior that I was seeing kind of just naturally in my dogs. It's kind of as a result of play, which...
Yeah, and I think one of the things that's so interesting about that example to me is that if you kind of start erasing those artificial boundaries between humans and other animals, you start to see your own behavior and their behavior as so similar. Like when you see kids doing these amazing extreme skiing moves and your dog doing these kind of crazy twist moves, we're all doing the same things and we're all kind of in it together.
That's one of the more stunning realizations, especially when you have a pack of dogs. One of the things that happens when you have a pack of dogs is personality is something that reveals itself, obviously, through comparison. So when you have a big pack, it's very easy, or it gets easier, shall I say, to separate species behavior from breed behavior from individual behavior. So you can kind of go, oh, that's, you know, that's what Dagmar is doing, rather than, oh, that's what dogs do, because you've got so many,
right,
you can compare them. One of the more humbling kind of experiences, exactly what you're talking about, is after being exposed to so many, over the years now, so many different dogs, a couple hundred probably at this point have passed through the sanctuary one way or the other, and after seeing so much different personality, you start to realize that, I don't want to throw a number at it, but let's do it anyway, 70%, 60%, 70% of human behavior is stuff that dogs do all the time, especially, you know, when you have a large group of them, you see cliques form, you see all the kind of, like,
right,
you know, you see yourself in high school, first of all.
I mean, clearly
do you see yourself in high school. But it's really, I mean, you're absolutely right, and it's kind of a stunning and humbling, you know, kind of blessing.
And it also speaks to the kind of falseness of the accusation, oh, you're anthropomorphizing your animals. Now, some people do dress their dogs up in tutus and tiaras and stuff, and I can see, you know, you're anthropomorphizing your animal, but when you attribute human characteristics to your animal, in fact, you might as well be attributing dog characteristics to yourself, and it's kind of the same thing.
Absolutely. Yes, you're correct. The other thing is, and I just have to say this, as this is my PSA, the idea that anthropomorphization is bad science was an idea that, you know, had a really, 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 really great hold around the time that B.F. Skinner was doing his work and Pavlov was doing his work and whatnot. It has since kind of been thrown out, and now most people who work in and around animals will tell you that anthropomorphizing with your animal is the absolute best thing you can do to figure out what's going on in your animal. And here's why, by the way. We know from the work of Jacques Poncet that all animals, all mammals, have essentially the same emotions as we do. As Darwin himself pointed out, and Darwin wrote a fantastic book on animal emotions. I mean, people, obviously, he's very, very famous for Origin of Species and whatnot, but this book is almost as good, though perhaps not as influential. But one of the things that Darwin pointed out is that, you know, evolution is continuous, and so changes are in variations in degree, not of kind. So we now know animals have all the same emotions as we do. They may have feel them slightly less, and various things, and, you know, different emotions may be different, you know, maybe important depending on which environment you grow up in, and all that kind of stuff. But we all have mirror neurons. We all have face reading. These things make anthropomorphism kind of the hallmark of really good science, right? So yeah, maybe dressing your dog up in the tutu is not, you know, is not quite right. But certainly looking at your dog and going, wow, he seems to be, you know, acting jealous. Well, that's a good first step.
Or depressed, know, or fulfilled, or all the
things. All those
things,
yes.
We're talking to Stephen Cutler, author of the book A Small Furry Prayer, Dog Rescue and the Meaning of Life. So we've talked a lot about evolutionary theory and, you know, neuroscience and all this kind of stuff. How do you actually apply this to healing and training down and out chihuahuas?
Well, the simple version is we try to create an environment at Rancho de Chihuahua that's very similar to the one that dogs evolved in, which sounds really fancy, but if you can do that, if you can create an environment that's similar to the ones that dogs evolved in, dogs feel safer, and they feel safer, there's less stress. There's less stress, there's better long-term health outcomes. So when humans and dogs kind of co-evolved, first of all, before the advent of agriculture, humans believed they were equal to the dogs, right? That hierarchy, the dominion over the beasts and all that stuff, that is something that emerged with agriculture. It wasn't something that was always in there. In fact, most archaic peoples believed that humans and animals were equal. So,
which is why they appear in our mythology, and I don't know if they have a mythology, but if they do, we're probably in it.
Absolutely. I'd like to see what the dog mythology looks like. But so, I mean, some of this is really simple. You know, dogs and humans used to den together, right? They all used to get in a big pile and just sleep together. And we do that at, you know, at Rancho de Chihuahua twice a day. It sounds silly, but we specifically, I mean, we sleep with our animals. We never cage our animals. We share our house with them. We live family style with them, all that stuff. We treat them as equals. But we also, we call it denning time, where we have a very, very big bed. And we get in there and, you know, and it's very important that we're at the same height as the dogs, believe it or not. And we get in there and just...
Which you can only do if you're in bed, if you're talking about a chihuahua.
Exactly. And we have, you know, our dogs range in size from pit bulls to chihuahuas, but they're most of them are chihuahuas, which, by the way, allows you to get way more of them into the bed, right? which is helpful. But, I mean, you know, why is that so good? Well, denning time, among other things, releases oxytocin and serotonin, two neurochemicals that are hugely beneficial. Both of them are immune system boosters, they're mood boosters, so if you could get them flowing through the dogs, you've got really, really, really powerful, powerful, powerful healing chemicals, probably two of the most powerful healing chemicals around, flowing through your animals. You're also building up trust, you're also bonding them to the pack. It's simple stuff. One of the other things that happened, you know, when we evolved with wolves and dogs, we were not at the top of the food chain, right? So we take our dogs every day off leash 5 to 7 miles through the backcountry. We intentionally put them into riskier environments. Do this for a lot of different reasons. One of the reasons is when you introduce risk into the equation, you get more beneficial neurochemicals. You get dopamine, which, you know, underpins romantic love, so it enhances pack bonding. It also boosts the immune system. And the reason you get it when there's risk is because it's a performance-enhancing neurochemical, right? It speeds up muscle reaction time and things along those lines, and pattern recognition, so you can kind of get yourself out of danger quicker. But we want everything else that goes along with it, and those things are usually, usually healing to the animals. So that's kind of, you know, the short version of how we apply some of this stuff.
Which is so interesting because it's not about punishment and reward, which are most of the ways that people use for thinking about dog training. It's a whole, and that's what we talked about with Kevin too in the Your Dog is Your Mirror book.
Yeah, and Kevin, I mean, Kevin's the only person I know who has kind of taken some of these ideas about mirror neurons and whatnot and actually said, okay, how can you use this as a training methodology? We're much more interested in healing our animals and getting them to be normal dogs. I'm not so big on, you know, sit, stay, calm, you know, all that. I'm not really a behaviorist. And when you're living with as many animals as we are, trying to train animals inside of a pack is incredibly difficult.
Right.
You can't, you know, on a certain level, you're just going to lose it because every time you introduce a new guy into the pack or a new gal into the pack, whole dynamic changes. Everything can change. It's one of the things that's very unusual about dogs, oddly. This is a tangent, but I'll tell you really quickly, because I've never understood it, is it's not kind of like when we went to high school. When I went to high school, you had your clique, and somebody new comes into school, and maybe they might kind of squirm into your clique and whatever. But what can happen with our dogs is we can introduce a new dog into the equation. One new dog shows up, and we've got 25 others, and all of a sudden, every single clique that has been existing for the past 6 months shifts. Everything changes. All of a sudden, everybody's got new friends, and I don't know why that is. It's a big puzzle to me,
right.
And I don't have any answers for you, but it's really interesting to see.
We're talking to Stephen Kotler. I don't want to go go too much into this, but back to this question of, which everybody asks, how are human beings distinct, qualitatively distinct from other animals? And there's many ways that you've been talking about that we're not. It turns out that our emotions are so similar. It turns out that dogs laugh, that they perform, that they dress up. I mean, in your book, we talked about this the last time we were on the air together. There was one little chihuahua you had that liked to do almost like drag shows, things like that. But there are some things, I mean, I joked a moment ago about if they dogs have mythology, but in fact, dogs probably don't have mythology the way that we do. They don't necessarily observe the world in a kind of philosophical detail and just love of learning that we do. Perhaps no other animals do that the way we do. We had just last Friday somebody on who was talking about, she took her son to see an exhibit of insects, and the little boy said, this insect looks like my airplane. And of course, we build airplanes based on our perception of insects. We do all kinds of things. We swim down in the ocean the way dolphins and fish do. We fly up in the air the way birds do. We build tall buildings. There are gazillions of things that we do and that interest us that I don't know if you can attribute those things to animals.
Well, one of the, if not the, kind of world's leading experts on this question, what is different between humans and animals, is a guy named Richard Granger, who teaches at Dartmouth. He runs the brain engineering department at Dartmouth. And I know Richard a little bit, and we've talked about this at length, and he will flat out say, if you kind of look at the neuroanatomical differences between a human and dog, for example, or human and most mammals, chimps, for another example, you'll find maybe 10 microscopic, tiny little differences in the brain. And none of them can account for things like culture and language. I think, personally, the answer to your question, I think, is what is actually different between humans and most other animals. And I can't speak for cetaceans, whales, this may be a little bit different. We definitely know that there is culture in animals, and that it persists over lifetimes, right? Persists across generations. Information gets passed down. There's cultural transmission in animals, which is also something that I've seen in my own dogs. But it's not recorded, and a lot of it seems that it's a difference in time perception. Animals seem to live much, 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 much more in the now than we do. And because of that, if you live much more in the now, it changes almost everything. It's a very, it sounds like a funny thing, but time is real, and perception of time is so fundamental. It's also kind of the new field in neuroscience. What does time look like in the brain is the new hot topic in research. And nobody's really we're just now starting to figure out how important time is in the human brain, and very little work has been done in animals. But my assumption is when they actually start poking at that deeper and deeper and deeper, you're going to start being able to answer this question, is why are we so different from, because obviously there are differences, right? My dogs, as much as I love them, as powerful as I think they are, they don't write Hamlet.
Right. And as the one time I had Jane Goodall on the air, I asked her a question along those lines, and she said, pretty much what you're saying, we do long-term planning. We think years into the future, whereas a dog is living in the here and now. But I do find it interesting that so much of the spirituality that people have sought out, who are spiritual seekers in the 70s up to the present, are in fact how to be in the moment.
And it's really funny. I mean, on a certain level, you're dealing with the difference between chimps and dogs in a funny way, because chimps actually we definitely got our long-term planning skills from our primate ancestry, not from our kind of canine ancestry.
If you can call it ancestry.
Well, ancestry is a loose definition.
Cohabitation.
Well, because of the impact of wolves and dogs on our morality, which I won't go into now, the new thinking is that, we may be as much part wolf as we are part chimp. But chimps definitely exhibit long-term planning. And the reason they exhibit long-term planning is they ate fruit, mostly, and they had to know where ripe fruit was, which means you have to be able to think into the future. Oh, the apples, it's green now, but it's going to be red 3 months from now. That's when I have to come back.
Right.
wolves never did that. So, you know, all the spirituality stuff, which it kind of is funny to me because you don't see, sometimes we see it with orangutans. You've seen, there are cults around orangutans, but you don't, you actually do see wolves very in the moment as kind of a centerpiece in a lot of mythologies. You don't often see primates. I don't know why that is. I haven't poked into it, but I do think it's interesting that, you know, the more an animal lives in the moment, the more we seem to kind of want to fetishize that animal. That's a little bit of Claude Levi-Strauss, though.
We're talking to Stephen Kotler. Now, a lot of people asked you, when you were on book tour for this book, A Small Furry Prayer, people who'd been dragged to the events by their dog-loving friends or spouses or whatever, and they were not themselves dog lovers, said to you, why should I care about dogs? Why should I care about animals? What is it? What is this stuff?
Well, I'm going to put this in really crass terms, because it's the easiest way for people to kind of get this answer. So ecosystem services is a term we use for essentially what the things the environment provides us with for free.
Clean drinking water.
Clean drinking water. Pollination services. Cleaning the air. Blah, blah, blah. On and on. Wood production. Food production. These are all ecosystem services. Now, Amory Levins and Paul Hawkins and a couple other people have calculated how the value of the ecosystem services we get per year, and it's roughly $40 trillion, which is essentially the global economy. So, and what we learned with Biosphere 2, among other things, is that ecosystem services are not things we can duplicate. We can't do them for ourselves. Mother Nature has to do them. So their value is equal to the output of the global economy per year, and we can't duplicate them. Okay, so that's just kind of, we'll put that to the side for a second. So, for ecosystem services to persist, we obviously need healthy ecosystems. For healthy ecosystems, one of the things we've learned over the past 15, 20, 30 years is that we need what are called keystone predators. These are the animals at the top of the food chain. Really simple example of what happens when you get rid of keystone predators. We got rid of wolves and coyotes in Connecticut, and the deer population exploded, and Lyme disease happened, and you now have the second largest, you know, second to AIDS, the largest infectious disease in the world. It's an epidemic. It's global. It's what happens when you remove keystone predators from the species, from the food chain. So here's the thing about keystone predators. They need lots of space, lots and lots of space to exist. It's the only way they can manicure ecosystems and they can do their jobs. Well, obviously, if we're going to give animals lots and lots of space, you have to care about them. And most people, they don't care. They're a lot more selfish. They don't think, oh, well, the health of this wolf is going to protect the ecosystem, which is going to provide me with ecosystem services. My argument is one of the reasons that we want to kind of, it's easier to care about dogs, is dogs are kind of the gateway drug into all this. We co-evolved with them. We're built, we're hardwired to kind of care about them in this way, and it's kind of a doorway into caring about the rest of nature. But we have to learn to see nature and care about nature and value nature. Whether or not you want to go pet a polar bear, it doesn't matter. Human beings cannot survive without ecosystem services at all whatsoever. We'll perish. And if you talk to most scientists, they will tell you that the threats to biodiversity, which is essentially threats to ecosystem services, are the gravest ones we're facing today.
So basically, love your dog, love nature.
Yes.
Stephen Kotler is the author of the book A Small Furry Prayer, Dog Rescue and the Meaning of Life. He is co-founder of Rancho de Chihuahua, which is in Chimayo, and he will be speaking this Wednesday night at Santa Fe Complex at 6 o'clock, talking about, of course, dogs. Thank you for being with us again here on the Radio Cafe.
Thank you, Mary Charlotte.
You've been listening to the Santa Fe Radio Cafe. My name is Mary Charlotte. We're streaming live on the web at ksfr.org, podcasting at santafe.radiocafe.org. Thanks to Dotfoil Computer Services. You can subscribe to the show on iTunes. You can find us at facebook.com/radiocafe. And my email address is radiocafe@ksfr.org. Stay tuned for the BBC, then local news, then jazz.